I think just well, there were such great ball players in the Negro Leagues then. You just you wonder how many of them, you know, Buck O'Neill and Josh Gibson and those guys. I'd have loved to see those. I love watching the history, Ken Burns, you know,
right,
of baseball, and watching that and how they changed the game. Well, they're great athletes coming out of those leagues and stuff. So
I think the speed of the game certainly did change.
Yeah.
And also Satchel Paige is another one that, you know, of course, I'm too young to have even, you know, I would like to have seen him as well. What was the influence the same with the Hispanic player as well? Because I think of Roberto Clemente. I remember my grandparents used to take me to Pittsburgh and Cincinnati in the summer when I'd visit them in West Virginia to see a ball game. And I will always remember two players from Cincinnati: Ted Kluszewski, because he was built
the arms.
Like,
yeah.
Because of the arms, and Roberto Clemente.
Yeah.
I mean, just an amazing athlete.
Yeah, yeah. It's just I feel fortunate growing up here and watching, you know, being able to watch the Giants and the great players they had, and you know, every now we'd get a glimpse of Roberto Clemente, you know, or a Mickey Mantle or a Yogi Berra on, you know, one that was only one game a week. I think the game of the week. Yeah, it's such a blessing that it's a game all over the world now.
There was a story you told me once. I think it was you were riding with your dad in the car, and were you going to the ballpark or something? It had to do with Willie Mays. And
well, it was when the Giants came to San Francisco opening day. I went to the first ball game. I've been to all three openers here. Candlestick and Seal Stadium when the Giants opened there, and then I worked home plate at the new ballpark here. So, but we went to opening day at Seal Stadium, and after the game was over, my dad took me down to the dressing room. So I'm going to go in and meet Willie Mays, and I was so excited to meet Willie Mays. And the actor Jeff Chandler was in there, I remember, and I could care less. I just was looking right past Jeff Chandler. My dad introduced me, and I looked back looking for Willie. And you heard this high-pitched voice in the back, and there was Willie. I remember my dad took me over to the locker, and I meet Willie, and he pulled out a brand-new glove and gave it to me. And so on the way home, I mean, I was hanging the glove out the window. This is Willie Mays' glove. And, you know, I was 9 years old at the time, I think. It was something.
What is it about baseball? I remember an incident when I was down going to the Giants training camp one day, spring training. And I was walking behind, the kid must have been about 6 or 7 years old with his father, and he had a glove on, and he had a ball in his hand and everything. And I was listening to his dad telling, well, you know, we're going to see this player, and we're going to see that player. And that transformation that father and son particularly go through, what is it about the game that brings that out?
Oh, it's just, you know, if you think back, you think of playing catch with your dad. You know, I remember my dad hitting me fungos and stuff at the schoolyard. And then when my kids were little, you know, Eddie is my oldest, who ended up at Pepperdine. He was the first team all-conference player there. And then Brett, my youngest, is now playing at the College of San Mateo. I better say, so I'll talk about my daughter. She played a little soccer and stuff. But just the baseball with the father-son, and you watch that movie, The Field of Dreams. I mean, that brings tears to my eyes every time I see it. It's just, you know.
Let's go back to your early days of umpiring. What was it that made you decide to go in that direction?
I couldn't hit the curveball. You know, I grew up playing and stuff, and I played semi-pro around the Bay Area here. And, you know, when my dad said, look, you could probably sign and go to A-ball, he says, but you're not going to get much higher than that. And then my mother says, you know, why don't you try umpiring? And I said, no way. And then I looked into it, and I saw the advertisements for the umpire school in Florida, Harry Wendelstedt. Actually, it was Al Summers at the time, and the umpire development program run by Barney Deary.
Is that the same path that people would use today?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. The umpire development's not around. Harry Wendelstedt, Hunter's son, is running it right now, and Harry still oversees it. And I believe Jimmy Evans has a school.
Did you have any doubts early on in your career that you might or might not be able to make it?
No, I thought right when I went down there, I said, well, this is going to be easy. I said, I know the game of baseball, and it got to my first week on the field, and I thought, well, I don't know anything at all about umpiring. So it was some transformation, but it was a good one because I never umpired before, so I didn't really have a whole lot of bad habits.
Is it harder for umpires to make it to the major leagues today, you think, than it was when you were starting out?
You know, it's all about the turnover. I was very fortunate. I mean, I came up in 4 years. I worked with some great older umpires, Paul Runge, Jim Quick, guys that kind of took me under their wings and showed me the ropes. In 1976, Shag Crawford and Chris Balakutis retired, and Fred Flagg, who was the supervisor of the umpires then, the office was right here in San Francisco. They called me down and said, you know, we want to take a look at you in spring training, but we want you to work these last two games of the season at Candlestick Park. And that was 1974. So I remember going out there, and the first game that I worked behind home plate. And if you look at the attendance for that game, I think there were 1,200 people in the stands, which to me felt like 52,000 people. It didn't matter.
They could hear everything you were saying, couldn't they?
Oh, yeah, yeah, but it was exciting. It was, and, you know, I was fortunate to come up as quick as I did.
How long did it take you to get a hard shell about what either players would say, managers would say, or the fans would say?
Well, the fans, you don't, especially with a big crowd, you don't hear that individual. I think when you're coming up as a young umpire, and I always thought I was very hard-nosed coming up as a young umpire, had a lot of ejections the first few years, and then it kind of calms down a little bit after that. They learn, you know, about me, I learn about them, and, you know, you just, you get a feel for the game and for what's said and stuff. I've always drawn a line as far as abusive language and stuff like that.
Did you ever have any favorite managers? And when I say favorite managers, people that you got to know over the years that you got to respect by the way that, you know, the way they managed?
Oh, you think, you know, Jimmy Leland, I mean, Roger Craig, you know, I mean, there's so many of them. I mean, Tommy Lasorda and I used to go nose to nose, just like, you know, and you've got Bobby Cox, who's a great manager, and you see Bobby going nose to nose, but, you know, if you see him in the parking lot, he'd do anything for you. He's a terrific guy. So there really, have I had any that I really dislike? There's been a couple that were just tough, and they held grudges, I think. One managed here, Dave Bristol. I mean, Dave and I used to go round and round all the time.
Yeah. I remember when I was up in Seattle in the early part of my sports broadcasting, they had, for the 1 year, they had that Seattle Pilots ball club up there.
Oh.
And I forget who the manager was, Freddie Hutchinson.
Mm-hmm.
It was Freddie Hutchinson. And Freddie never swore. He always had a way, though, of getting his point across. And I guess he came out and challenged something. And he was really unhappy about it, but he didn't use any bad words. And he started to walk away, and he turned around and he said to the umpire, and he got run for this. By the way, I stopped by the dog pound, and your mother's fine.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there's some guys. You know, over all the years, Lasorda, I've only tossed Tommy out of a ball game once, and I remember it was over balls and strikes. And we have a rule, and had a rule in the National League. Well, we still do. And it was they can't come out on the field and argue balls and strikes. So I remember it was Bert Hooten was pitching, and Tommy's out in the mound, and he's delaying. And I walked out to break him up, and I knew he wanted me to come out there. And I said, Tommy, let's go. He says, Eddie, what was that pitch? I said, Tommy, first off, you can't question me on the pitch and stuff. Now he's going to argue me about the rule, whether he can argue or not, over balls and strikes. So I said, let's go. And so he says, well, bring in the left-hander. So we bring in the guy. And as I turned my back and started to walk around, and he says, well, you missed it anyway. And I said, and you're done anyway. See ya. But, you know, I mean, that was the only time with Tommy. But, I mean, he does bring that up to
me. And there are some managers that want to get run just to fire up their ball club, aren't they?
Oh, sure, sure.
I mean, that's just a tactic that they use.
Yeah, I remember Preston Gomez when he was managing the Cubs. I had called a balk on, I think it was Suter. And Preston, who was the nicest guy in the world, and he was one of the guys that you just didn't want to toss out of a ball game. And he came out and argued with me, and I let him stay a little longer than normal. He didn't, no abusive language or anything like that. I said, Preston, look, and I don't want to toss you. He says, but let's go. And so finally, and he wanted to get tossed. So he says, Eddie, he says, you son of a gun.
Well,
and I said, Preston, now you got to go. So,
yeah. And of course, over in the American League, Earl Weaver was renowned for the way he worked umpires.
Well, I didn't have to work with Earl. So,
how did you develop your calls and balls and strike style? Because you'd put up that fist and call it right away.
You know, I'm not really sure. It's just something I started. I used to come up, and I still do every once in a while, come way up and out. And I think that the way I developed the quicker is I wanted to stay with the pitch longer. So instead of delaying, it looked like I delayed the call and coming up, I just would, you know, shoot it out real quick. You know,
you were on the field for a couple of very auspicious moments. You were the second base umpire when Barry Bonds hit his 715th home run to pass Babe Ruth for second place on the all-time list. You were at first base when Pete Rose singled to break Ty Cobb's all-time hit record in Cincinnati. When there are great moments like that, what is it that sticks with you about those moments? Because I think players and umpires probably look at them differently than the media and the fans would be.
Well, it's history. This is such a great game, baseball. And like I say, if you look back and you look at the history of the ball game, I mean, when I remember standing at first base when Pete Rose broke that and Ty Cobb's record, and when he came out and Steve Garvey and I were standing alongside each other, I mean, a lot of stuff went through my head, and I'm thinking, you know, he just broke Ty Cobb's record, and your dad played with Ty Cobb, played against Ty Cobb, you know, so those things go through your head. And when watching Barry, you know, break the record like that, and, you know, and through my head goes Willie Mays. Bobby Bonds was one of the first things I thought of, his dad. I wish his dad was there to see that. And I told Barry on the field, I said, your dad's watching you. You know, I said the same thing. Rose, you know, you have a feel for the game. It's kind of everything else leaves, and you're just thinking, wow, you know, what you just saw. I mean, it's just, you're lucky to be out there.
Is it a little bit upsetting to you, somebody that's been around this game for such a long time, to think that two of the biggest names associated with the game, Barry Bonds and Pete Rose, tainted in the way that they are?
Yeah, you know, it bothers me. I just wish some of this stuff never happened. I mean, it's if you're any kind of fan at all, it bothers you. I don't know. To me, I mean, Barry is one of the greatest hitters. You know, one of the most locked in hitters I ever saw for years. I mean, and then of course Pete Rose, what he brought to the game, and with his hustle, and I just remember the crowds. I remember being there when Rose was going for DiMaggio's record, you know, when he got to 40, 38, 39, 40, 42, and the crowds that would come out to see him. And it was just like, just one person, what one person does of the game, just like Barry here in San Francisco. I mean, he packed them in. People came to see him. And, yeah, it's kind of sad. I kind of just like to, you know, not think about that stuff and, you know, wish it didn't happen.
Well, the one thing about Barry that I remember at the end of his career, again, I was down at spring training. I think it was probably maybe even the last year he was with the Giants. Watching him at the batting cage, how quickly he could get the bat through the zone. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's bat speed, and that's what it really comes down to. I mean, take away the allegations, but it still comes down to talent to a great degree. And the bat speed, I mean, that to me is what I'll never forget.
Yeah, and I remember talking to, I've known Barry since he was a kid, you know, since coming around with his dad. And so I always felt comfortable talking with Barry. And, I remember asking him about, there was a lot of stuff going on off the field. And it was like, I've got two kids. How do you stay focused and stuff? And I remember him saying that, he says, I'm only going to see one pitch during this ball game. And when that pitch is thrown, I'm going to hit it. I mean, so it was always, to me, it was in his head that he was focused on every single pitch. And I find that helped me with umpiring. And when you're sitting back there and behind home plate, and if you're really in the zone or in the game, every single pitch you are thinking. I mean, if you let your mind go for a second, you're going to lose it. You know, it's I always called it the reset button. I'll step back and say, okay, let's go. Here's the next. If you miss a pitch, I said, press the reset button, go back. Let's get this one, you know.
The one thing that I've always said is that the fans have no idea how good these athletes are, no matter what the pro sports are, because, first of all, they're competing against their peers. Where I've gone to certainly those camps where they have, you know, former major leaguers, and you know, they're just so good. When you look at these athletes, from your perspective of somebody being that close to them consistently, what do the great ones do? I'm talking about the Barry Bonds, the Willie Mayses, the Willie McCoveys, the Pete Roses. Those people are a step above. What was it? What is it that they do, Ed, over the years?
Well, one thing, you're born with a lot of that. And the other thing is just their work ethics, I think, and their conviction. I always remember over the years, before we had the hotel workouts rooms and stuff, I'd go down to the ballpark, and I'd, when the ball players weren't in there, I'd go in and use their facilities. But there was always one in every park, and it was like Steve Carlton was always in there, Nolan Ryan in Houston. You know, it seemed like when the other players weren't in there, they were always in there working. And I think it's just their training, I mean, and stuff like that. And like I say, you have to be born with it. You have to have those instincts. But then, you know, they put a lot into it, too.
What about the pitchers you've seen over the years? We haven't talked about pitching.
Oh, well, I mean, people ask me what game stands out, and there were quite a few. But I remember Tom Seaver, a game I worked home plate, throwing against the Pittsburgh Pirates, and I think he struck out 19 that day. And that was, you know, Stargell and Parker and Sanguian, and those were the big boys then. And I did that. That was one of my earlier games, you know, my first or second year in the league. And, you know, I just remember that. I remember, you know, Steve Carlton, the great pitcher that he was. And then Maddox, Glavin, you know, Smoltz, that crew they had over in Atlanta was unbelievable.
Umpire Ed Montague leaves umpiring with no regrets. Moving on to basketball, Al Attles has been with the Warriors organization for more than 50 years as a player, coach, and general manager. He played for the Warriors for 11 seasons, coached the team for 13-plus, winning an NBA championship, and was general manager for 3 seasons. Attles was also part of one of the NBA's greatest games, Wilt Chamberlain's 100-point effort. I read a story about Attles, and I was caught by a quote from him. He said, "I'm still amazed at how it all fell in place." I asked him what he meant by that.
Well, if you look back in the history of my career, I went to a small college in North Carolina. I grew up in New Jersey. There were only 8 teams in the NBA at that time. So if you weren't drafted either 1 or 2, you very seldom had an opportunity to make a basketball team. I was drafted by the Philadelphia Warriors, and it was really a situation where it was local players who played college basketball in that area, with the exception of Wilt, who played high school basketball in Philadelphia. So really, getting an opportunity to make that team was going to be very, very difficult, because I was going against some people from Temple, LaSalle, Paul Arizin. I obviously went to Villanova, and Wilt went to Overbrook High School. So it was going to be Ernie Beck went to University of Pennsylvania. So it was going to be very, very difficult for me to make the basketball team. I really wasn't thinking about it very much, and even though I was drafted, and things just kind of worked out, so I just happened to be in the right place at the right time.
How did African Americans look upon professional basketball? What kind of opportunity did they see it to be, or did they even see it to be an opportunity?
Well, I think that most African players who played in college really thought more about the Globetrotters. In fact, the Globetrotters came to college that I, unbeknownst to me, and talked to my college coach, and he kind of steered them away from me, and I found that out later. But there weren't that many players. We talked about someone earlier, Earl Lloyd, and of course Don Barksdale from the Bay Area, and Chuck Cooper, and there weren't that many players, Sweetwater Clifton, and so there really weren't that many blacks who were really playing in the NBA. In fact, there was an unwritten quota that it first started with 2, and then they bumped it up to 3, and later on when I got there it was 4. So really, there weren't that many African Americans playing in the league, and the Globetrotters were kind of the team that most black people identified with at that time.
You were going to be a PE coach?
Yes, I had my keys to my room, and I was going to be a recreation teacher, and later on, hopefully, get into coaching in the high school level, but on the high school level. But it never materialized.
How did you find out you were drafted by the Warriors?
Well, I was going to lunch. I was going through the line to get my food, and a young lady at the college came up, and she said, "Congratulations." And I said, "For what?" She said, you know, the season was over, obviously, and she said, "Congratulations." I said, "For what?" She said, "You're a professional player." And I said, "What do you mean I'm a professional player?" She said, "Well, I heard it on the radio this afternoon before I came to lunch, and she didn't know what it meant, just said I was drafted, and she thought I automatically had made the team." And so I said, "Well, that's nice to hear." And I went on and got my lunch and ate and didn't think very much of it. And the next day was in the newspaper. And a friend of mine who was a writer in North Carolina by the name of Irwin Smallwood called me and told me what had happened. And I never thought very much of it. But it was a nice gesture on her part, but I never thought very much of it.
And you blew off the invitation to the Warriors camp first?
Yes, I did. And the friend of mine who I played with named Vince Miller, who had played high school basketball with Wilt, but he went to A&T and I played with him. He broke his knee his junior year, so he went back to Philadelphia, and that was Wilt's first year. And he was working for the 76ers, and he talked to Eddie Gottlieb, and I think Eddie really drafted me to keep Vince quiet. Vince kept telling him about this guy from Newark and played with him at A&T, and so Eddie probably heard that a million times, and he said, okay, we'll draft him. Maybe Vince will shut up. And so then, when it came time to go to training camp, Vince called me and asked me, you know, when was I going to training camp? I told him I wasn't going. And he said, why? And I said, well, you know, I have a job, and I really don't think very much about my chances. And I was drafted by the Baltimore Bullets in the Eastern League, so I was going to play on the weekends and teach school during the week. And Vince said, no, you can go up there. You can make that basketball team. I said, well, you know, I really, really don't think I want to even try it. And then some other things happened. So I lost a job because I got my greetings to go to the Army. So I didn't want to take a job for 2 weeks and then go for a physical. So I told people I couldn't take the job. So I took enough clothes for a week and went to training camp. And here we are.
What was the league like back then?
Well, it was, I remember Jack McMahon telling me something. It was kind of a closed session, closed area where people got to know each other very well, and their wives knew each other. So the players really, really had a kind of a close-knit kind of situation. And, you know, very seldom did players who, unbeknownst to other players, get an opportunity to make a basketball team. So when I went to try out for the Warriors, like I said, I took enough clothes for a week, and I had no illusions about whether I was going to make the basketball team again. The one thing I did find out, the first day of training camp, we had Tom Gola, who was a great player coming out of LaSalle. We had Guy Rogers, who was a great player coming out of Temple. Of course, Wilt. And then we had Ernie Beck. And we had Paul Harrison. I really, really found out the first day of training camp that whether I made the team or not, I found out I could play with these players. I didn't know if I was going to make the team, being a fifth-round draft choice. I didn't know if I'd make the team. But I found out that at least I could, you know, be on the floor with these players. And obviously, 50 years later, it might have worked out.
Your salary the first year?
Well, you know, we didn't have agents. We didn't have anyone who could negotiate for you. And I remember reading the newspaper, Hal Greer, who played for the old Syracuse Nationals, moved into Philadelphia later on. He became, you know, one of the top 50 players. I remember he had a contract at negotiations, and he put it in, it was in the newspapers. He signed for $7,500. And, you know, we didn't have agents or anything like that. So when Eddie got leave, how much I, you know, wanted, I told him $7,500. And Eddie, a real negotiator, he looked at me and he told me, he said, too much. And I was offered $4,500 to teach school. And then I was going to play in the Eastern League, so I probably would have made a little bit more than $7,500. So when he told me that was too high, I said, well, how much do you think? And he wouldn't tell me, but he wrote it on a piece of paper and turned it over like you're playing cards, and he slipped it over to me. And I don't play cards, but I know how to play cards. And I, you know, picked it up and put it on my chest and kind of looked at it. And I kind of got this funny look on my face because he put $5,000 down. And unbeknownst to me, when I looked at the paper, he looked at me. So I was looking at the paper. He's looking at me. When he saw the look on my face, he said, okay, I'll give you $500 more. So I grabbed the pen, signed the paper. But in all honesty, at the end of the year, I got a bonus for being the only rookie to make the team that year. So they gave me an additional $2,000. So I did make the $7,500.
What kind of guy was Eddie Gottlieb?
I got to know Eddie very, very well. Eddie was a businessman. And he told me something that I've always remembered. You know, Eddie and Abe Saperstein were partners with the Globetrotters. And they had a pipeline of African-Americans going into the NBA. So Abe would allow one or two to go into whichever team he designated every year. And of course, Eddie being his partner, they would always end up with the Globetrotters. And first, in fact, Eddie, my first roommate was Andy Johnson, who had played for Eddie Gottlieb, but he also played for Abe Saperstein with the Trotters. So most people looked in terms of African Americans playing for the Globetrotters. So Eddie, unbeknownst to to a lot of people, really, really didn't realize that, because they would have double headers in Philadelphia at Convention Hall. So the Globetrotters would play the first game, and the people would come to see them. And at the end of their game, everybody would leave. So Eddie felt that, people wouldn't come to see them if they played in the NBA. So years later, he and I, after we became friendly, he told me if he had known that people would come to see black players in the NBA, he would have had them coming a long time ago. What really changed his mind, obviously, was when we got Wilt in the territorial draft. And so everything kind of changed. But he and I became very, very friendly. And he admitted that he made some mistakes early, but he corrected them later on.
How was the game played at that time? Was it a perimeter game? Was it set shots until maybe somebody like Wilt and Bill Russell came along?
Well, it was really kind of a massage the basketball kind of game. And that's why when Russell went to the Celtics, everything changed, because he ignited the fast break and they got the run. And in fact, before he got there, they weren't a very, very good basketball team. They had Cousy and a couple of Sharman and some Ed McCauley and people like that. But when Russell got there, he changed the culture of the game, both defensively and offensively, because they ran the ball. And so in order to compete and be on the same level with the Celtics, you had to start running, and that's how I was drafted into it with the Warriors.
And you mentioned about the Globies. How were they viewed in the black community, and how were they viewed among black athletes?
Well, among athletes, we view them as, the way to continue playing basketball after college. And, of course, the community embraced them, because they were the, organization that they could go and call their own, so to speak. So what would happen is, I can remember my father taking me to see the Globetrotters before a Knickerbocker game. And, what I was saying earlier held true, because a lot of people were starting to leave after that first game. But you saw a number of black people in the audience that you hadn't seen on a professional level. So I think they were like the area of basketball that most players who played, particularly in that era, knew that was an opportunity for them to play basketball after college. And like I said, my college coach, Cal Irvin, who was Monty Irvin's brother, he steered me away from them, because they played basketball. In fact, they had some championship games that they played against the Lakers with George Mike, and they won series against them. I think they had 2 years in a row they won. So they really, really played outstanding basketball. I got to know Marcus Haynes later on, and they were outstanding players. And what they would do is, they get a big lead, then they would go into the Showtime thing, whereas a lot of people thought that they were Showtime players, but they were excellent basketball players before the Showtime got in.
Let me ask you about something that Eddie Gottlieb said to you. He said, "You're not very good, but we're going to keep you. And in order to keep you, the Warriors had to trade away another black player, since the unwritten NBA quota that season was 4 blacks per team." Tell me a little bit about that attitude and how angry it might have made you or anybody else to know that there was this quota.
Well, Eddie, after you got to know him, you found out he was a businessman. So going back to what happened with my contract negotiations, he felt that if he said you made the team, that would be enough to get a little bit more money from him. But if he said you're not, he didn't say I wasn't very good. He just said, we're going to keep you, which in effect was saying, you're okay. And so what we'll do is we'll keep you. So your negotiating power changes versus, you made the team, which you can negotiate for more money. So I think the perception was, he was more of a businessman. And like I said, he became a person who understood that the league was starting to change, and people would come out and see other players beyond, going to see the Globetrotters. So I think it was an awakening for him. And he told me this. He said if he had known early on that people would come see you play, regardless of what you look like, he would have changed his stance long before he did. But when he was doing it, he looked at it from purely a business standpoint.
You and Will Chamberlain became very, very close friends. And believe it or not, when I think about Wilt, and I ran into him once at a bar, and we had he was very nice to me, had a very nice conversation. But I had Bill Russell sitting in that seat where you were, and a lot of people thought that they didn't like each other, but it was anything but that.
No, they were very close.
They were very, very close. But the first time you saw Wilt Chamberlain, tell me what your impression was of him.
Well, as I said, I had played with a player who played with Wilt all through. It was Wilt, he was Wilt's best friend, named Vince Miller. And so, you know, I had an opportunity to see Wilt when I was in college, because when he came after his second year at Kansas, he came to Greensboro to pick up Vince to drive him back to Philadelphia. So I met him. That's when I first met him. But I'd also played against him in the playgrounds. We used to have all these different teams that would play. Like Newark had a team, and Philadelphia had a team, and New York had a team, and Washington, D.C. had a team. So we go and play each other during the summer as well. They came, the first time I played against Wilt was at Weequake Park in Newark, and something really interesting happened. He was coming down. I was back on defense by myself, and he's coming down on a break by himself, and usually you try to take a charge. Well, I got out of the way, and he went in and dunked the ball. And I remember we all laughed about it. And I said, you know, he said, I'm glad you moved out of the way, because he said, I probably would have hurt you. And I said, you probably would have. But no, we became very, very close. And Guy and I were like so-called three musketeers. That was Guy Rogers, who had played at Temple.
How comfortable was he with his height?
Oh, he was very comfortable. It was interesting, because if you went into a room with 25'7" or better foot players or people, he would stand out. And there was just, you know, he had a body that just kind of stood out among a lot of the big people. And he wasn't one of those guys that slouched over and tried to act like he was smaller than he actually was. And, you know, years later, you found out a lot of, you know, big, tall players do that. But back then, they were kind of, you know, didn't want to let people know how tall they were. And that whenever they stood next to someone else as tall, they would hunch over so they wouldn't be the tallest person in it. But Wilt never had that problem.
I always had a sense that he went through a metamorphosis when he went onto the court, that he was a different person off the court than he was on the court. Am I correct in that observation?
Well, no question. People got to know Wilt, who didn't know him early on, found out he was a lot different. Then I remember some things that happened. You know, my wife and my children, we went down to visit him down in Los Angeles, and he had just had this house built. And, you know, it had the roof that opened up, and, you know, I mean, it had so many perks in it. And my wife and my son and daughter, they stayed there in the house the whole time. They didn't want to go out. And Wilt didn't really want to go out that much. In fact, we were kind of captives. He wouldn't let us go out. He wanted to stay in the house, and he cooked. But we did go to the movie, and we went to see a movie. And a lady was writing a book about him. And the lady was in the back, and I was sitting in the front, and he was sitting in the front. And so we get to the movie, and it's around the line. I'm, you know, it's around the block. And the lady says to him, she says, you know, you go to the front of the line, and, you know, you, Will Chamberlain, we can go in. And he said, no, I don't do things like that. And we went back home, and we came back the next day. The movie was The Alien, and we went to see that. And people would never understand that. And there was another situation. We got into a track meet. And Vons, the supermarket chain down in Los Angeles, put on a track meet. And they had a special section for the so-called celebrities. And we were sitting up there, and Wilt and I and this lady and her son, his attorney, she was an attorney of some kind. She was sitting next to Wilt, and her son asked Wilt for an autograph. And he kept saying no. And so she really, really was upset about it. And she kept saying, you know, how can you, you know, turn a young man down? All he wants is your autograph. And we listened to this for the whole track meet. And the last event in the track meet was the relays. And so we sat there, and for 2 hours he was listening to this lady talk about how she just thought it was terrible that he wouldn't sign this autograph. And right before the relays started, he turned to her and he said, Miss, he said, let me ask you a question. He said, why did you come to the track meet? And she said, well, I came to see the track meet. And he said, okay, give me the paper. And she gave him the paper and a piece of and a pencil. And as soon as he started to write one letter, everyone around us stood up and wanted an autograph. And he turned to her and he said, that's the reason I didn't want to sign. He said, because the people and you would not be able to see the track. And then we left. But he was that kind of person. And he also did some things where he donated some money to some people, the track team and whatever. And he said, now, don't tell anybody I did this, because I'm not doing it for people that know I'm doing it. And then there was one here in San Francisco that really was funny. He and I and another fella went out to breakfast one day. He, at the end of breakfast, he picked up the tab and laid down a really a big tip. I mean, really, really big tip. And so we left, and the guy said, "Will, I forgot something. I left something at the table." And so Will said, "Al," he said, "watch this." He said, "Watch what happens." And so we kind of stood on the side, and the guy went back into the restaurant, looked around, and he picked up the tip that Will left. And so when he comes out, Will like goes ballistic, and he is so upset at this guy. And I mean, he said, "You know, if you needed money, why didn't you ask me?" But to do that, and he said, "We'll never go to breakfast again with that guy." He was just a great person to be around. And years later, I remember someone doing an article on him, and they said, "All these years, we thought he was a lot different than he was." I mean, he was a star, let's be honest. But he was the kind of a person that a lot of people, once you got to know him, in fact, he did another thing for me, which I often laugh about. You know, he had that Rolls Royce and was a sports model. And so when he got traded to Philadelphia, he told me, he said, "Al," he said, "I want you to drive this, while you're here." And I told him, I said, "No." I said, "What you're going to do is you're going to park that car, and I'm not going to ever see it again." I said, "Because if I drive it and get a scratch on it, it would cause me my entire salary to get it fixed, so I never drove it."
You told a story about a player who ran into some contemporary basketball players in Detroit. I wish you'd repeat that again.
Well, that was Earl Lloyd, and he and I became very, very close. And to this day, we're still very, very close. And he told a story after he finished playing. He was working for the Board of Education in Detroit. And he had gone on a road trip somewhere, and he was coming back into the Metro Airport in Detroit, and he had to, pass some NBA players who all had earphones on, and they were going up. This is before they had private planes like they do now, and they were going up the concourse. And Earl's the kind of player that he'd walk over and he's 6'6", and he'd go over and say, "How you guys doing?" or something like that. And I guess he just went over just to say hello and whatever. And he said the guys looked at him like he had done something wrong. And so he just kind of went on. And I remember saying, "You know what? These guys didn't know that if it had not been for him and, Sweetwater Clifton and Don Barksdale and a couple other players, we don't know where they would have been." But and he said it just kind of, was sad because he wasn't doing it because he wanted anything from anybody. He was just being friendly and just saying hello. And here was a guy that kind of set the stage for a lot of those players.
When you take a look at those players that did set the stage for today's players and everything, what was it that collectively they did that made the game better?
Well, I think what they did is they understood the importance of being a team player. For instance, I remember talking to Sweetwater Clifton, who later on, after he finished with the Trotters, then he went to the Knickerbockers for a long time, and he ended up being a cab driver in Chicago. And I remember meeting him, one of the games in Chicago, and where I got a chance to say hello to him, and we spoke about some things. And he went to DePaul, and I remember I didn't know him in college, obviously, but I remember him saying when he got to the Knickerbockers, he had certain limits that was placed on him. All he was supposed to do was play defense and rebound the basketball. And he had been a big scorer, from what I understand, at DePaul. And he wasn't allowed to play the game that way. And it wasn't until Oscar Robertson came into the league that black players, Oscar, but it was Wilt. Wilt came in first, and then Oscar. But when Wilt came in, he was such a great player that they allowed him to do. And then Elgin Baylor before that. But, you know, it was Elgin and then Wilt and then Oscar. When those three players came, they said, hey, you can't put limits on these great players because they can play, you know, this game as well as anyone. But, you know, if it hadn't been for those three, I don't know where players would have been who looked like them.
Oscar Robertson, of course, the only player to average a triple-double for an entire season. The other thing that I think about, of course, is that there was a crossover time in professional basketball, and I think that critical time, Al, was probably the early 1980s, because the late Bob Wolf, mm-hmm. who was a friend of mine, who was an agent for Larry Bird,
right.
mm-hmm. and others, said to me that in 1980, the league almost went away. Its championship games were played tape delay at 11 o'clock at night. There was a drug problem that existed in the league at that time, and he told me that the league was mortgaged to the tune of $90 million in deferred salaries. Was that indeed a critical time in the moving forward of professional basketball?
Well, I think the two people who are mainly responsible for that are Larry Bird and Magic Johnson. I think there were problems, and many times when the problems exist, you don't really know they're existing. You know, I can remember a very, very good friend of mine named Steve Jones who played in the ABA, and he used to tell me stories that they would leave practice with their uniforms on to go to the bank to make sure they collected the money before it all ran out. And if you took a shower and you were late getting to the bank, you know, you didn't get paid. And so they would go sweaty and whatever, going to, you know, get the money. But, we never had a check bounce, to my knowledge. But we never knew, you know, the ins and outs of the team. And there was some problems in the league back, you know, when they were going through the tough times. I never missed a paycheck, never bounced. But you didn't know, you know, people mortgaging things that we never knew. And it wasn't until Larry Bird and Magic kind of changed the culture of the league because, you know, it was really, really a tough time prior to that. And then once that happened, everything started going uphill because, you know, now, you know, later on Michael comes in and some other players and everything changed. But I understand that it was a tough time.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is the demarcation line. I mean, what you've got is you've got primarily black players playing mm-hmm. the sport today, and you've got white customers.
Mm-hmm.
I remember talking to Coop one time with the Lakers, and I said to him, I said, you know, how do you feel when you're going down the court? He says, I look around. He says, I don't see hardly any black faces. Mm-hmm. And so the money has changed, I think, attitudes of people mm-hmm. because they don't have a value for something. I mean, if you lost $1,000, that would be 20% of your salary at mm-hmm. that time. And then, you know, the necessity for guns and all of that. I mean, those are the things that concern me about the league. And I don't know whether it's just something that will come around and go around or not, Al.
No, and you have to keep a tight rein on it at all time because I've always said, unfortunately, there are a number of people who are doing really positive things in the NBA. But unfortunately, the people that we hear about are that small percentage who are not doing things according to Hoyle, so to speak. So what happened is the perception by a lot of people is they all do this, and they all don't do this. I mean, if you look around and you would go back into some of the things that are going on, we have a number of players on every organization and every team who are doing outstanding things for the community, outstanding things. But what happened is every time something happens with one of them that is going against the grain, the perception is that a lot of people think that way. And they say, well, they all do that. And they all don't do that. But what happens is if they think that way, then we have to change the culture of those people who think that way to say, you know what, these guys aren't, all of them are not like that. And unfortunately, because of the makeup of basketball and the closeness of basketball, for instance, in baseball, you know, if you sit out in the center field stands, you can't see very well. And if you go to a football game, and, you know, this is football season, you go to a football game, a guy has pads on, whatever, you don't know who's who. But when you go to a basketball game, they're right there. And you can tell exactly what they look like and who they are and what happens and who's acting up and who's, you know, being a good guy. And unfortunately, you know, if you carry it over into your stands and you hurt some, you know, some spectator, then people are going to say they all like that. Let's not go watch those guys. You know, I might get, you know, my wife might be here. My child might be here. I might get hurt. So what happens is they don't want to do this. So you have to be very, very careful. And I think the league does a great job of monitoring that out, but you have to stay on it, you know, as they say, 24/60.
What's your favorite memory?
My favorite memory is the day that in St. Louis, 1960, I don't know the exact date, when Eddie Gottlieb told me, he said, "We're going to keep you." He said, "We're going to keep you." And then my other one was when I got married. That was the other one.
Al Attles, a man with a unique view of pro basketball. I hope you've enjoyed U.S. Airways' in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, and you'll listen to our live broadcast on radio, the American Forces Network worldwide, SiriusXM satellite radio, and the Internet. And if you'd like a listing of Sports Byline USA's radio affiliates, be sure to check our award-winning website. You'll find that at sportsbyline.com. I'm Ron Barr, and thanks for being a part of America's sports talk show, Sports Byline USA.